listener production. This is Global Truths with Dr. Keith Suter. Join us each week as we break down one issue in global politics so that you can understand what's going on in the world right now and what's likely to happen in the future. Our host, Dr. Keith Suter, is one of Australia's leading commentators on global affairs and geopolitics. My name is Sasha Tanick. I'm a journalist. And Keith, today we're talking about a book called America Second, How America's Elites Are Making China Stronger by author and journalist Isaac Stone Fish. Now, first of all, do you agree with the premise of this book, which is that some of America's elite, US politicians, business leaders, have aligned themselves with Chinese interests for their own gain?
Yes, I do. And that's what I found so fascinating about the book, the amount of detail this person goes into. Isaac Stone Fish was based in China for some years. He's a little apologetic now for some of the stuff that he wrote in such glowing terms. So he's trying to distance himself from an earlier life, so to speak. And what he's doing in this book is to say how with individuals like Dr. Henry Kissinger, we've got a number of Americans and American institutions that are basically promoting China, sometimes quite explicitly that they've got China as a customer, other times because they want to have China as a customer. And so this is distorting their attitude to some of the big issues. Remember, when you think about China, you've got the whole question of the potential invasion of Taiwan, you've got the occupation of Tibet, you've got Xinjiang, which is also in the western part of China, that's got concentration camps for holding perhaps as many as a million Uyghurs, Muslims. So it's interesting that you've got these host of issues with China, and yet there is a desire not to focus too much upon those bad aspects. And instead just see China as this wide open economic market and just talk about China in pure economic terms as a trading partner. And this means therefore playing down the Western tradition with human rights concerns.
So before we explore some of those issues, you did mention Henry Kissinger. Historically, do you think his relationship with China is significant? And do you agree that he has amplified positive voices about China and suppressed the negative ones?
Absolutely. And Isaac Stone Fish is particularly focused on Henry Kissinger. So the background to this is that Richard Nixon came to power in November of 1968. The Vietnam War was still underway, and Nixon had made a career of being an anti-communist. And he had argued that America needs to improve relations with the Soviet Union and with China in the hope that they would put pressure on Vietnam to pull out of the war. Now, as it happened, that didn't work. I've got to say that I was in Vietnam during the war, and I've been back on a number of occasions since then. And what struck me during the war is that almost all the heroes in Vietnamese history have been people who have stood up to the Chinese, all the way back to the AD 64 and the Trung sisters. So the idea that somehow America could do a deal with China for China to put pressure on Vietnam was really quite fanciful. But nonetheless, it did open up a completely new chapter in international history, because it meant that America helped bring China in from the cold. So you'd had the revolution in China in the late 1940s. China had endured centuries of appalling violence, Japanese aggression, civil wars, etc. When the communists took over, they brought a very brutal form of stability, but they also had mass murders, etc. And Richard Nixon was one of those who was able to build his career being anti-Chinese communist. But then Kissinger and Nixon working together. So Kissinger was the advisor to Richard Nixon and then was appointed when Nixon became president to originally be the national security advisor and then later the secretary of state. So Kissinger and Nixon between them said, what we've got to do in order to get out of Vietnam with a sense of honor is that we have to improve relations with China, get the Chinese to lean on the Vietnamese to allow the Americans to leave. The phrase is after a decent interval. And so the Americans would pull out, and then later on, the Viet Cong would take over the country. It didn't quite work out quite that neatly. But what happened is that America began the process of opening up China, bringing China in from the cold. China had a minute economy at this time, had a lot of people, but not much economic activity. And yet you had a number of American business people who were saying, look, you know, this is the law of large numbers. We got it in Australia with the Australian Wool Corporation, who said if we can get every Chinese person to wear one woolen sock, we'll have sheep grazing on the Melbourne cricket ground. So this law of large numbers, when you're talking about 1.4 billion times anything else, gives you an idea that some people are saying, well, there could be economic potential. And so Kissinger arranged secretly, without telling his own State Department, that he was negotiating for Nixon to make this visit to China. This was a turning point in relations, not only between the United States and China, but it also created no end of heartburn for the far right in America, who were seeing their far right president suddenly getting cozy with Chairman Mao Zedong, and also for left-wing groups in the Western world, who suddenly noticed their hero, Mao Zedong, getting friendly with Nixon. So this was a visit that really transformed politics. Eventually, Henry Kissinger fell out of favor with the government. Henry Kissinger was really not fully appreciated, should we say, by Ronald Reagan, who became the leader after President Carter. Reagan decided to take a very hard line against communists and therefore had no interest in détente or improving relations, etc., referred to the Soviet Union as the evil empire. And so Kissinger in 1982 found himself on the outer. And so Kissinger created a company called Kissinger and Associates, which would then, on a confidential basis, work for clients to help them to get trade in a variety of countries. Remember, this is one of the most influential diplomats in American history. So he had a huge range of contacts. So Kissinger had been employed as a Harvard professor, which is not necessarily well paid. Then he went to work for the US government, which is certainly not well paid. And now from 1982, he suddenly landed in the big money, because so many corporations said to Henry, can you set up a meeting with us, with key individuals? And of course, some of those key individuals were Chinese leaders. It's all done confidentially. This came to light after 9/11, when the US government wanted to create a commission of inquiry looking at the terrorist attack in 2001. And it was decided originally that Henry Kissinger would be appointed to it. But then a lot of people saying, yeah, but we don't know who their customers are. There may well be Saudi Arabians as customers of this very shady and influential company. So Kissinger stood down. But that was further spotlight on Kissinger's immense connections with all sorts of leaders around the world. So Isaac Stone Fish acknowledges that Kissinger is a genius, brilliant at negotiations, helped transform American foreign policy after World War II, but at the same time is conscious that Kissinger smoothed China's entry into the United States and provided it with scope to be influential for American corporations.
So when it comes to the China-US relationship over the years then, do you think some of these America's elite have been well-intentioned and truly believe that engaging more with Beijing and creating a strong and stable China would in fact be a positive thing for the US and the rest of the world, or was it always corruption?
Well, and Stone himself is not clear. Stone Fish is not completely clear on this. He acknowledges that it's much better for America perhaps to be friends with countries rather than fighting them. He acknowledges that you do have people like Kissinger who've got good contacts, who are working for peace because not too much money will be made from war. But at the same time, that could actually be making America weaker. It reduces America's implementation of the values that it's got. And China is a very shrewd operator. China plays the long game, which is worth emphasizing, because in the Western world, we have politicians with the concentration span of a flea. Whereas China work over a long term. They're not worried about elections, etc. So they can think long term. And what they've done is to recognize particularly the power of American cultural institutions. So basically you have two types of power. You've got hard power, which is military power or police power. Do this or I will kill you. The alternative is soft power, which is the power of attraction. The Power of Seduction. And that's where Hollywood is good. Hollywood makes the best dreams, which is why American tastes have become universal. Now, there are some people who despise Hollywood for its values, and that's part of the culture war going on in America at the moment. But the Chinese realize that they don't want to have a head-on collision with America. That may yet come later. We can't rule that out. But at the moment, what the Chinese want to do is to establish a foothold in the American cultural institutions and make sure that those cultural institutions are very pro-Chinese.
You're listening to Global Truths with Dr. Keith Suter. I'm Sasha Tanik, and Keith, today we're talking about a book called America Second, How America's Elites Are Making China Stronger by author and journalist Isaac Stone Fish. Now, you mentioned cultural institutions such as Hollywood movie industry. So what about the movie industry? You know, what's some examples of how that can influence that relationship between China and US, or how it can be influenced, more to the point?
Yes, Stone Fish argues that that you will never again, at least in the foreseeable future, have Hollywood-made movies that are anti-Chinese, because the Chinese market is so big that you always want to make sure you can show your movies there. So he argued in an interview that 1997 was the worst year for China in Hollywood. Three movies. I'm not an expert on movies, so I can't really comment on them. Kundun, 7 Years in Tibet, and Red Corner had all come out in that year, 1997. And the Chinese government decided that how China was portrayed was offensive. And so China, realizing the cultural power, the soft power of Hollywood movies, decided that it would be necessary to try to win over Hollywood. And they do that by saying, if you make movies that are critical of us, we will ban your movies. And so the CEO of Disney, for example, had to go to China to apologize for distributing movies that contained anti-Chinese government sentiments. So it is interesting. And now, of course, American presidents are reluctant to meet with the Dalai Lama, et cetera, so, because that would really anger the Chinese.
And in fact, we've seen an example in recent weeks with the latest Harry Potter movie, where they've agreed to censor a reference to a key character being gay for the version that airs in China. So you're seeing that influence even recently,
yeah,
in different ways through Hollywood.
And the Chinese view is that they're now running a thing called wolf diplomacy. So wolf diplomacy consists of Chinese actors who save the world, not Hollywood ones. And so the Chinese are a much more aggressive approach. So their wolf diplomacy is based on the idea the Chinese would never appear to be soft, but will always be strong, which means that they ban all forms of effeminate male behavior. So they're not interested in having gays performing. And that, of course, they look at the West and they say, look at what the West is like. You're falling into decay. Putin misinterpreted the strength of the West by looking at all the gay parades, etc., and figured, look, the West is becoming so decadent. This is a good time to strike in Ukraine. And the Chinese are saying, we don't want that sort of lifestyle taking off in this country. We want to portray ourselves as strong.
And what about universities? What role do they play in this China-US relationship?
Again, very important, because the universities are again concerned that you don't get too much anti-Chinese government sentiment being expressed on American campuses. Now, Chinese students are a major source of income for the United States, and they don't want to lose that market, particularly with COVID. You know, everyone's trying to recover where they were from 2 years ago. And so they want to make sure that they are very welcoming to the Chinese. And this means, therefore, turning a blind eye to some of the way that the Chinese, it's been alleged, the Chinese sort of monitor the behavior of fellow Chinese students.
So, Keith, does the US need more diversity when it comes to China-America issues and negotiating that relationship?
They need to recognize that there's more to China than just the Communist Party, absolutely. So they do need to build up links with more of the individual Chinese, but it's actually very difficult to do that. the Chinese can get into America a lot easier than Americans can get into China. And so that is certainly a limiting factor. I think the other challenge for our response is that we have to make sure that we are not seen as being McCarthyite or racist. So McCarthyite is a reference to Senator Joseph McCarthy, a drunken Irishman in the US Senate, who on one occasion, very famous, held up a list of communists working for the US government. But in fact, it was a shopping list. So he was a very flamboyant character. In the end, he drank himself to death. But the McCarthyism was seen as a way of excluding communists from the American government, which meant that when America got involved in Vietnam, there were no specialists on that part of the world. They'd all been sacked thanks to McCarthyism. So one of the issues that Stonefish raises is the challenge of being able to oppose the Chinese government without doing it in a flamboyant McCarthyite way. Now, the second challenge that we've got is that we don't want to become across as racist. And this is obviously a worry that Stonefish has, because you can imagine some of the people who don't like China in the United States are actually racist. And there is a history of racism in America, as there is, of course, here in Australia. So we need to find a way of being opposed to the Chinese communist government without offending the Chinese themselves, by trying to welcome in the Chinese as individuals and avoiding allegations of being racist. And of course, one of the ironies is that the United States will contain a number of Chinese who are in America precisely because they don't like the Chinese government. So they are the two challenges that Isaac Stonefish has identified in trying to deal with this threat.
So how do you think policymakers in the US should be thinking about America's relationship with China? I mean, should it be distancing itself or decoupling in some strategic areas? I mean, what's the way forward?
Well, nobody seems to have any clear strategy, right? We're all haunted by the book called Thucydides' Trap by Graham Allison at Harvard, which has looked at 500 years of European history and noticed the way in which you get a dominant superpower being challenged by a rising power. And of the 16 case studies by Graham Allison and his team, 12 resulted in war. And so the fear is that we will have a war between China and the United States. Now, ironically, of course, Russia comes along with Ukraine. So we're right off at a tangent. My view is that Russia was yesterday's enemy, but suddenly it's made itself today's enemy. But we've still got the whole problem of how we find a way of dealing with China. Ideally, as he argues, we need to have China as a weaker country. If it gets too big, then it'll end up causing all sorts of problems. We've seen that recently in Australia, for example, with the deal done between the Solomon Islands and China over a security deal. China is changing. China used to have what was called a brown water navy. A brown water navy is a navy that patrols around your own coast. It's now got a blue water navy. So a blue water navy means that it's a navy for projecting your power a long distance away. And to do that, you need bases, because you've got to find places to replenish your supplies, R&R for the sailors, etc. Now, the United States is somewhere between 300 and 600 of these bases around the world, including a few here in Australia. So China is going down that same path. And it is laid out by an English historian called Paul Kennedy, whereby you start out as a small trading country. You begin to develop trading links overseas. You then develop a military to protect those trading links. You get involved in foreign wars, and then you bankrupt yourself. In my textbook, I've added, and then you end up as a tourist attraction. Why else would anybody want to visit the Netherlands today? And yet 300 years ago, the Netherlands was a superpower controlling New York, New Amsterdam. So you've got this sort of cycle. And the tragedy is we don't learn from history. And China is beginning to go through that same sort of cycle of history. And what the Chinese are doing is not just relying on military power, but they are using economic power and cultural power and trying to get control of the institutions in a very subtle way. But nonetheless, it's this old pattern that you get richer and you then want to project your power overseas. And that's what gets you into trouble eventually.
Yes, Keith, certainly a fascinating book. It raises some very complex issues about that America-Chinese relationship. I look forward to the next episode of Global Truths.
Thank you.
Listener.